use of antibiotics without a prescription.
Artificial intelligence and chest x-rays to assess mortality.
What can coronary calcium scans tell us about heart disease in younger folks?
And should we continue screening for hepatitis B infection in pregnant women?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on July 26th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn right to Annals of Internal Medicine, this use of antibiotics without a prescription in the U.S. This is a meta-analysis taking a look at a bunch of different studies with a bunch of different inclusion criteria. The background, of course, we know this already, is that antimicrobial resistance is increasingly problematic all over the globe. I was surprised by this estimate of treatment costs for antibiotic-resistant infections now exceed $2 billion annually. Additionally, reactions to antimicrobials have accounted for about 19% of all visits to EDs in the United States for adverse events. They took a look at four populations in this study: patients or parents of patients outside healthcare settings, patients or parents of patients within healthcare settings, Hispanic and Latino populations, and injection drug users. What they found was that the use of antibiotics without a prescription varies from about 1% among those patients who have visited clinics to 66% among Latino migrant workers. Another phenomenon is people hoard, if you will, or hold on to antibiotics. They call this antibiotic storage, and that can vary from 14% to 31%. And then those who intentionally use non-prescription antibiotics was 25% in this study. Now, they offer some caveats, and I know you're going to agree with this, that this is somewhat of a skewed study population, but that's because of the paucity of studies that are out there on this. And they suggest that, gosh, we really need to do some additional studies.
We spend a lot of time talking about the patient-provider interaction, that is, targeting antibiotics to the right patients and minimizing the duration of them and making sure that they're not used to treat viruses and things like that. But this is the first study that's actually looked at where the patient themselves end up taking antibiotics that haven't been prescribed by the physician. And to know that one in four patients do that is really pretty interesting. You didn't highlight what some of the reasons are. This paper did mention some of those. First of all, individuals have easy access because a relative or a friend provides them. Sometimes they've stockpiled antibiotics. Many individuals do that. They don't complete their antibiotic course and they keep it in the medicine cabinet for when they feel that they need it. And then other individuals can have access to it from the internet or other countries, for example. And that's why, at least in the community I live in, a lot of Hispanic and Latinos will go across the border and get antibiotics in Ciudad Juarez and bring them over in the United States. And then some individuals don't feel like they have good access to healthcare. Migrant workers, for example, or day workers that can't take a day off from work. There are a lot of different reasons. At least one study attempted to minimize that by advertising it and saying, listen, you shouldn't be doing this. And interestingly enough, non-prescription use actually increased from 19% to 31%. They thought, well, gosh, we brought unnoticed attention to it, and now more people are doing it. This information that is prevalent, we need to take it a step further and say, how can we decrease it?
Exactly. So that absolutely is going to require further study. Let's turn to one of yours. Which one would you like?
Let's talk about hepatitis B virus infection in pregnant women.
And that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
It is, and it's the United States Preventive Services Task Force Reaffirmation Recommendation Statement. It has been recommended in the past that women who are pregnant get screened for hepatitis B virus. Despite that, only about 85 to 88% of women do. Now, the reason why this is important, because it's passed on to the child. 90% of the time, the child will get it unless it's recognized. We can give prophylactic immunization to the child. We give IgG antibodies at the time and also a vaccine at the time. And we can lower that from 90% to about 5%. Well, what the USPSTF did in looking at the recent data, it reaffirmed that, yes, women should be screened. There's no harm at all to screening the mother. And another important thing is if mothers have an extremely high viremia, that is a lot of viral particles in the blood, they'll actually start treating that mother while she's pregnant, because those children may be resistant to the treatment delivered immediately after birth. If we can lower the viral load, those children have a much better chance of being cured. Now, what's the risk if you don't recognize this. Well, 90% of the children will develop an infection. About 50% of them go on to develop chronic liver disease, and about a fourth of them go on to die of their liver disease before they reach adulthood.
You know, we have a really effective vaccine for hepatitis B, so why aren't we just recommending that everybody be vaccinated?
In fact, that's what the recommendation is for children now.
Why wouldn't we say, hey, are you Hep B positive or not? And if you're not, why don't we just go ahead and vaccinate you? Adults.
Elizabeth, that's a great question. And in fact, as you know, all healthcare providers receive it. People are entering college receive it. So I agree with you. It should be delivered. As you know, there are some people that really don't want to be vaccinated. It's not just a single vaccination. It's repeated doses. But I agree with you. It's something we should aspire to. The other issue is, well, why not just screen high-risk women? Well, unfortunately, you miss 50% of the cases in pregnant women. So that's why USPSTF says, listen, screen every woman, once she's pregnant in the first trimester, or as soon as she's seen, screen for hepatitis B.
Okay, let's turn to JAMA Network Open. This study took a look at coronary calcium scanning in adults 30 to 49 years of age, which is not a population we would normally say, hey, let's go and get a coronary calcium scan in you. This is part of the CAC consortium, and it comprises over 22,000 individuals. And they tested them at baseline between 1991 and 2010 with follow-up through 2014. They found that in this sample, they had a relatively high prevalence of hyperlipidemia, a family history of coronary heart disease, and a low prevalence of current smoking and diabetes. They were able to determine that in this very large sample of young adults, 34.4% did have positive coronary artery calcium scanning. And those with elevated scores had significantly higher rates of both death and coronary heart disease in the follow-up period. So, suggesting that, gosh, maybe we ought to be screening people at a younger age.
So our listeners should be aware that as we age, we all develop or acquire some calcium in our blood vessels. We can grade that. Some people have a minimal amount, some people have a moderate or a very high amount. Younger individuals really shouldn't have any calcium or should have very minimal calcium. What drives that? Well, the usual risk factors. People have hypertension and diabetes and a family history of cardiovascular disease and high cholesterol, cigarette smoking. Those things all increase the risk of coronary artery disease and increase the risk of coronary artery calcification. And in this study, most of the individuals that had calcium, and certainly those that had very high calcium levels, over 100, had those risk factors. Do those people need to have a coronary artery calcium score to determine that they're increased risk for cardiovascular disease? In my opinion, the answer is no, because we already know that, because they have risk factors. So what individuals should have coronary artery calcification determined? Well, if they don't have the other risk factors, the typical ones, but a family history of heart disease, perhaps those individuals, because even though they don't have traditional risk factors, if they have an inordinate amount of calcium, we might treat them with statins. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. So I'm not sure that this means everybody ought to have a coronary calcium score, but in individuals that lack the traditional risk factors, but there's some suspicion they may be at an increased risk, this can provide additional information that may increase preventative therapies.
And here they basically say their risk of dying of heart disease was tenfold higher among those with a coronary calcium score of more than 100. And we've talked before about, gosh, how predictive is it really? And we haven't really seen that it's been that predictive. So does this study help us improve the predictive value of this test?
So Elizabeth, what this study did establish was that the more risk factors you have, the higher your mortality, and one of those risk factors being coronary artery calcium. What this didn't do, however, was take the traditional risk factors and then say, what additional information does the coronary artery calcium score tell you that the traditional risk factors does not? That's one of the limitations of this particular study. But we would both agree that any of the risk factors that one has, hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, family history, or coronary artery calcium score, is associated with an increased risk. Now, the other thing we should mention is, even though we say it's a tenfold higher risk, this is a relatively young population, and their risk of dying of cardiovascular disease was about 0.1 or 0.2%.
More to come, no doubt. Let's turn to your final one, also in JAMA Open.
This was a really interesting study that took the most common diagnostic imaging test in medicine, that is a chest x-ray, and combined it with an artificial intelligence method known as convolutional neural networking to establish whether a routine chest x-ray could predict long-term mortality. This type of artificial intelligence or this deep learning means that information, chest x-ray, or in this case, 10,000 chest x-rays, are fed through many layers of information. The composition of each layer informs the next layer, so it's an iterative process that goes on and on, where it allows us to assess or analyze large data sets. They looked at a cancer preventative study that had about 15,000 individuals, and all these individuals, by the way, had a routine screening chest x-ray and follow-up chest x-rays, and then looked at whether they developed prostate cancer or lung cancer or ovarian cancer. And they took 10,000 of those chest x-rays, put them through the neural network, and said, can you predict who's going to die of anything, by the way? Then they took what they learned and applied it to 5,000 individuals in that same study. And then they applied it to about another 5,000 that were part of the lung cancer screening study. And here's what they determined. Using convolutional neural networking, or CNN, they could, in fact, divide people into very low risk or very high risk. Very low risk, by the way, was about a 4% chance of dying over 12 years. A high risk, about 53% chance of dying. And you say, well, of course they could, because they could find lung cancer. No, these were people that did not have cancer to begin with. They didn't have lung nodules. They didn't have adenopathy, big lymph nodes, but there are a number of other subtle abnormalities, maybe a little bit of calcium in the aorta, or a slightly increased heart size, or maybe a little of obesity. So for whatever the chest x-ray recognized, they could divide people into medium, low, and very high risk. Some of those people died of cancer, some died of cardiovascular disease. But the interesting thing was they could use artificial intelligence, a routine image, and predict with a high degree of reliability who was at high risk and who was at not.
Well, I think we're going to be seeing a whole lot more of this kind of stuff. And it's a little daunting, isn't it? The idea that a routine chest x-ray might be able to predict that, you have a 50% chance of dying in the next few years.
Right. As physicians, we wouldn't normally do that. In fact, we might look at an x-ray and say, oh, it has a little bit of this and a little of this, but otherwise it's normal. But in totality, all those little things really do matter. The other thing that's nice about this is you can put that chest x-ray up there and it'll perform the analysis in less than a second. With that information, then what the physician needs to do is, okay, your risk is 53%. Why is that? And oftentimes it's tied to other risk factors, the risk of cardiovascular disease, and we can do preventive things, or the risk of perhaps future lung cancer. We need to do lung cancer screening. So although this informs what the risk is, we need to take the next step and say, okay, let's dig down into why that particular individual is at high risk and what we can do to lower that risk.
And this AI, it's coming, it's here.
Is especially useful in things like radiography. And we've talked before about how it's useful for looking at eyes and diabetics as well. Things that use pattern recognition. And we can use tens or hundreds of thousands of images to inform the network, to inform us of what the risks are. This was a neat study.
More to come, no doubt. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.